My goal here at the library is simply to make the lions roar, to make a heavy institution levitate when I'm successful. I will, though, not say very much tonight. I would rather put you immediately in the presence of Edwidge Danticat. I would like her to read, which is something we rarely do. I rarely ask writers to come and read. I usually interview them or we have a conversation. But in this particular case, I felt it would be powerful and as well as necessary for Edwidge Danticat to read, and she will herself contextualize what she's reading, and after that we'll have a conversation together. So here is Edwidge Danticat.
Good evening. I have both the great pleasure and the mild discomfort of reading about someone who is here tonight. So it will be interesting. But first I wanted to read a little bit from Camus, Create Dangerously, the essay that inspired this book. It is said that Nietzsche, after the break with Lou Salome, in a period of complete solitude, crushed and uplifted at the same time by the perspective of the huge work he had to carry on without any help, used to walk at night on the mountains overlooking the Gulf of Genoa and light great bonfires of leaves and branches, which he would watch as they burned. I have often dreamed of those fires and have occasionally imagined certain men and certain works in front of those fires as a way of testing men and works. Well, our era is one of those fires whose unbearable heat will doubtless reduce many a work to ashes. But as for those which remained, their mettle will be intact, and looking at them, we shall be able to indulge without restraint in the supreme joy of the intelligence, which we call admiration. One may long, as I do, for a gentler frame, a respite, a pause for musing, but perhaps there is no other peace for the artist than that he finds in the heat of combat. Every wall is a door, Emerson curtly said. Let us not look for the door in the way out anywhere, but in the wall against which we are living. Instead, let us seek the respite where it is, in the very thick of the battle. For in my opinion, it is there. Great ideas, it has been said, come into the world as gently as doves. Perhaps then, if we listen attentively, we shall hear, amid the uproar of empires and nations, a faint flutter of wings, the gentle stirring of life and hope. Some will say that this hope lies in a nation, others in a man. I believe rather that it is awakened, revived, nourished by millions of solitary individuals whose deeds and works every day negate frontiers and the crudest implications of history. As a result, there shines forth fleetingly the ever-threatened truth that each and every man, on the foundation of his own sufferings and joy, builds for all. So now I will read about someone who attempts to build for all. And this essay in the book is called Create Dangerously. On November 12, 1964, in Port-au-Prince, Haiti, a huge crowd gathered to witness an execution. The president of Haiti at that time was the dictator François Papadoc Duvalier, who was 7 years into what would be a 15-year term. On the day of the execution, he decreed that government offices be closed so that hundreds of state employees could be in the crowd. Schools were shut down and principals ordered to bring their students. The two men to be executed were Marcel Numa and Louis Douin. Marcel Numa was a tall, dark-skinned 21-year-old. He was from a family of coffee planters in a beautiful southern Haitian town called Jérémie, which is often dubbed the City of Poets. Numa had studied engineering at the Bronx Merchant Academy in New York and had worked for an American shipping company. Louis Douin was a 31-year-old light-skinned man who was also from Jérémy. He had served in the U.S. Army and had studied finance before working for several banks here in New York. Marcel Numa and Louis Douin had been childhood friends in Jérémy. The men had remained friends when they had both moved to New York in the 1950s after François Duvalier came to power. There they joined a group called Jeune Haïti, or Young Haiti, and were two of 13 Haitians who left the United States in 1964 to engage in a guerrilla war that they hoped would eventually topple the dictatorship. The men of Jeune Haïti spent 3 months fighting in the hills and mountains of southern Haiti, and eventually most of them died in battle. Marcel Numa was captured by members of Duvalier's army while he was shopping for food in an open market, dressed as a paysan. Louis Douin was wounded in battle and asked his friends to leave him behind in the woods. "According to our principles, I should have committed suicide," Douin reportedly declared in a final statement at his secret military trial. Chandler and their guest, two other Jeune Haïti members, were wounded. Chandler asked his friend to finish him off. Gerdes committed suicide after destroying a case of ammunition and all the documents. "That did not affect me," said Douin. "I reacted only after the disappearance of Marcel Numa, who had been sent to look for food and some means of escape by sea. We were very close, and our parents were friends." After months of attempting to capture the men of Jeune Haïti and after imprisoning and murdering hundreds of their relatives, Papadoc Duvalier wanted to make a spectacle of Numa and Douin's deaths. So on November 12, 1964, two pine poles are erected outside the National Cemetery. Radio, print, and television journalists are summoned. Numa and Douin are dressed in what, in an old black-and-white film, seems to be the clothes in which they had been captured. Numa, the taller and thinner of the two, stands erect in perfect profile, barely leaning against a square piece of wood behind him. Douin, who wears brow-line eyeglasses, looks down into the film camera that is taping his final moments. Time is slightly compressed on the copy of the film I have, and in some places the images skip. There is no sound. A large crowd stretches out far beyond the cement wall behind the bound Numa and Douin. To the side is a balcony filled with school children. A young white priest in a long robe walks out of the crowd with a prayer book in his hands. The priest spends some time with Numa, who bobs his head as the priest speaks. The priest then returns to Douin and is joined there by two uniformed policemen who lean in to listen to what the priest is saying to Douin. The firing squad, seven helmeted men in khaki military uniforms, then stretch out their hands on either side of their bodies. They touch each other's shoulders to position and space themselves. The police and army move the crowd back, perhaps to keep them from being hit by ricocheted bullets. The members of the firing squad pick up their Springfield rifles, load their ammunition, then place their weapons on their shoulders. Off screen, someone probably shouts, "Fire," and they do. Numa and Duin's head slump sideways at the same time, showing that the shots have hit home. Duin's glasses fall to the ground, pieces of blood and brain matter clouding the crowd lenses. On November 12, 1964, after Marcel Numa and Louis Douin's bodies were carried away, some say to the National Palace to be personally inspected by François Papadoc Duvalier. A lanky 13-year-old boy who had been standing in the back of the crowd to avoid the thunderous sounds of the executioner's guns stepped forward as the spectators and soldiers scattered. He walked towards the bullet-ridden poles, bent down in the blood-soaked earth, and picked up the eyeglasses that Louis Douin had been wearing. The young man, the photojournalist Daniel Moel, only momentarily held the eyeglasses in his hands before they were snatched away by another boy. But in that moment he had them, he had noticed the tiny chunks of Douin's brains splattered on the cracked lenses. Perhaps if he had kept them, he might have cleaned the lenses and raised them to his face to try to see the world the way it might have been reflected in a dead man's eyes. Sometimes in Haiti, the eyes of murder victims are gouged out by their murderers because it is believed that even after death, the last image a person sees remains imprinted in his or her cornea as clearly as a photograph. Before witnessing the execution of Marcel Numa and Louis Douin, Daniel Morel was not particularly interested in dead men's eyes. He had been like any other boy, going for long walks all over Port-au-Prince and playing soccer with his friends. He sometimes worked in his father's bakery and tried to climb aboard Haiti's commercial train, which brought sugarcane stalks from the southern fields of Léogâne to the sugar-making plants in Port-au-Prince. But the execution changed everything. The next day, Daniel walked by a photographer's studio near his father's bakery in downtown Port-au-Prince, and on the open panel doors were enlarged photographs of Marcel Numa and Louis Douin's corpses, purposely put on display as deterrent for the country's potential dissenters. These pictures were exhibited there and elsewhere for weeks, and young Daniel Morel would walk past them, and even though he had been at the execution, he saw them each day as if for the first time, and was unable to look away. Photography is an elegiac art, the novelist and essayist Susan Sontag writes in On Photography. All photographs are memento mori, that is, they remind us that sooner or later, the subject will no longer exist. To take a photograph, Sontag continues, is to participate in another person or thing's mortality, vulnerability, and mutability. Photography has something to do with resurrection, Roland Barthes wrote. Might we not say of it what the Byzantines said of the image of Christ, which impregnated St. Veronica's napkin, that it was not made by the hand of man? Arche ro poetos. I never intended to become a photojournalist, Daniel Morel tells me more than once in the time that we have known each other. I became a photojournalist because at Numa and Douin's execution, I felt afraid, and I've never wanted to feel afraid again. I take pictures so I'm never afraid of anyone or anything. When I take pictures, I feel like something is shielding me, like the camera is protecting me. Did he, as a boy, want to protect Numa and Douin, I ask. He could not protect them, he said, but over the years, he felt as though he had managed to protect other Numas and other Douins with his photograph. And he makes me even more certain that to create dangerously is to create fearlessly, boldly embracing the public and private horrors that would silence us, then bravely moving forward, even when it feels as though we are chasing ghosts or being chased by ghosts, even when it seems as though we full-heartedly believe in Arche ro poetos. Thank you.
Edwidge, it's really a great pleasure to have you here tonight. We now know, or at least in your rendition, we know why Daniel Morel became a photographer. A photographer he became because of an extreme situation in some way that called and beckoned him. Do you feel there's a parallel between his urgency to capture a moment in time and archive it in some way and make it live and make it continue to live and resurrect it and your own work, your own need perhaps, urgency to become a writer and to create dangerously?
First, I just want to say it's a great pleasure. When I kept telling people that I was coming to be interviewed by you, they were saying things like "he rocks." And
well, and I am interviewing Jay-Z next week. So, cool. So, and I actually think in some way this interview is a very good prelude.
Okay, can you tell JC that?
I will. I promise you.
And so thank you for having me. And I also want to acknowledge Daniel, who's here. I told him I was going to embarrass him. So
I must say that chapter 11 of Create Dangerously on Daniel Morel is perhaps one of the most extraordinary essays I've read in a long time. Actually, it leaves you virtually speechless. But let's continue.
Yeah, thank you.
Because we have a lot to talk about, so I cannot be speechless.
I don't think that's going to happen with you.
No, actually, Edwidge said, I'll be fine as long as you don't bring up some obscure Camus quotation. Or if you do, read it twice so that we know what you're saying.
I think what I had always been so curious about, you know, how people come to their art. Because I always felt in a way, I grew up in this, you know, in this family with a lot of storytellers, with a lot of stories, some of them good, some of them bad. But it was always something that fascinated me, if one is able to even trace. I mean, there's this whole mystery of art, and I remember having this fascination myself with these two men who had lived here and then went back and just lost everything. You know, just really literally lost everything, and they had lost family members, which had driven them out of Haiti, and then they had gone back to kind of save us all. And that just, the story was for me epic and amazing. And I had never met someone who had this similar connection to it. And when Daniela and I talked about it, it was like, wow. And it was amazing that how he's being able to trace what he does to that moment. And I think we all have, you know, create, you know, we just have this, sometimes you feel like you have a compulsion to do something, but you don't know where it comes from, and it doesn't need to be the quest of you know, of your entire earth, but it's, you know, it becomes, then there are things that are, I think, certain, you have a couple of images that reoccur again, and that might have something to do with sort of what you're trying to arrive at in the creation of your art.
And let's pursue that. What are those images for you? I mean, can you? I know it's a very difficult question to ask of anybody, and to ask of writers in particular, namely where it all started. In your case, you spent the first 12 years in Haiti. Is that correct? Mm-hmm. And then you came to the United States. Where did the urgency to write come from? What were those first obsessive images? You were mentioning Roland Barthes, and he quite beautifully talks about creating an organized web of obsessions. Mm-hmm. What was your organized web of obsessions early on?
Well, I mean, on some level, I feel like that's always changing, you know, these obsessions. And maybe there are sort of different formulations of the same obsession, which is, I think it has a lot to do with separation, silence, because, you know, for a lot of us, when you were kids, growing up in the dictatorship, for example, and in my time, sort of overlapped, some father, some son, you know, the father and son, Duvaliers. And there was always, you know, these sort of this code of silence of things that couldn't slip. I think so I'm intrigued by silence, you know, silence that's forced by outside and circumstances. But also, you know, I grew up with an uncle who had throat surgery and who maneuvered around silence, was a minister who couldn't speak. So sort of the contradiction of that. So silence, I think separation is sort of how families reformulate themselves, and violence. I think this type of violence too, and how on some level how certain people are victims, if you will, of it, or taken up in it, or sacrificed in it. but this notion how others who could escape, you know, are for themselves. And I think that's why this image of this execution is such a reoccurring puzzle for me.
What struck you at first when you read Camus' essay, misnamed, as I mentioned to you, Create Dangerously? It's an editor's choice. A translator chose to call it Create Dangerously, which then became a very good title for your own book. What's
lucky for me.
Lucky for you that an editor made this choice, yeah. Because in French, this lecture he gave in Sweden in 1957 was simply called The Artist and His Time. Mm-hmm. What was anchoring for you in this essay?
Well, there were several things. I mean, one of the things that he talks about in this essay and that he reoccurs in a lot of some of the other essays is that what he says, l'artiste ne méprise rien. The sense that, and I think it's harder to translate mépriser, whether you say it in Creole, in English, sort of like not ignore, not sort of look. It's sort of this thing of
denigrate.
Yeah, but denigrate maybe it's like one aspect, yeah. But you know, it's this sense of. But then this other thing,
devalue, because the word mépris means to. To give a bad price to devalue.
Exactly, devalue. Yeah. Exactly. And I think part of what was intriguing too is that I think coming, and when we're talking about this issue of literacy or people who read, and it's a privilege in a way if you come from a place where most people don't generally have, not everybody has access to education, the sense of how a large number of people are devalued, whether you know socially, culturally, fine, and that's one element of it. But also this ambivalence of sort of this wrestling with the place of this issue of the place of art. And he talks about the sense of you know artists, you're in trouble if you're silent. You're in, you know, people get mad if you're silent. People get mad if you speak. It's a this place where you're in. And I think he seemed to have had more than Sartre or the others more ambivalence and you felt like there was a sense of on all these essays that about art, his sense of trying to understand a little bit what he was doing. And that appealed greatly to me because I often felt, especially when I was started, that it wasn't even, this is not, I don't, it's not my birthright in a way. I think if people who grew up in a certain way, come from a certain place, you
what
feel like...
What is not your birthright?
This talking to you here at the public library, you know, all of it. And so it feels almost like an accident. I often say it's like an accident of literacy, you know, the fact that... And
you have that very sentence in the book, which is very haunting.
And so it feels as though then... this constant exploration of what it means and what you should use it for and all that is sort of this constant question.
It's so interesting you say this because for me, for you, it isn't a birthright to be here, you seem to feel, at least briefly, on this stage at the library. For me, I'm thinking, my goodness, on Monday I'm interviewing Jay-Z. What does this white kid with, you know, Mitteleuropa parents from Vienna know about hip-hop? It's the exact inverse in some very strange way. And I'm learning about hip-hop because I have an 8-year-old boy who's teaching me about the world that he inhabits now. And so in some way, what fascinates me about this is that through different forms of reading, and I'd like to anchor our conversation to some extent on the importance of reading, because in some way your book, I keep referring to it as if it were here, but it's in my hand actually, Create Dangerously, is an elegy and the power and the glory of reading in some way for an island where I think you quote a number of less than half people are able to read. More than half of the population is illiterate. and were not able to read in different ways, but not able to read books. So I'm wondering for you if this possibility made you feel like a true outsider.
Well, I think after your interview, Jay-Z, you'll become an accident of hip hop.
Yeah.
What's also fascinating, because in the book I also talk about many of our writers, and it's extraordinary the number that we have, you know, given all the difficulties and given the circumstances. And I don't think it doesn't feel necessarily like it doesn't, you know, it's the part of one of the cliches of the, you know, immigrant dilemma is that, you know, then the kids get super educated and they're alienated from their community. I've never felt that thing. And I don't even, though I live in a different even country from many of my family members and so forth. So I felt, I feel the privilege of this back and forth, but there is this feelings. I don't think it's, people often think with me it's language because I write in English, but I think there is a feeling that all people who write, for example, must feel the sense that a lot of people won't be, a lot of people who are dear to you, you know, in my case, even in my family, won't be able to participate in the story this particular way. But it's, you know, it's one of the constants of it. It's sort of one of the many pillars in the room as you're writing. And I guess part of this effort at creation is that to do it despite all these things, which a lot of the writers, some of the writers I mentioned in the book too, a lot of them have been able to do, because, and their voice, in a way, there's a writer like Jacques Womé, who wrote a book called Masters of the Dew. And it's interesting, this whole journey that Masters of the Dew traveled, because, you know, it's a novel set in the Haitian countryside by Jacques Womé, a Haitian writer who was not from the countryside. But what this, the you know, and then Langston Hughes translated into English. And then it was made into this radio play that aired on Radio Haiti. And people in the countryside then heard it. And it was as if sort of this voice that had traveled through this writer had gone back, and they could recognize it. And people named themselves, they named their children after the characters in the novel, which is, you know, I think the height of, it's probably the greatest honor any writer can have. So there are these possibilities. I mean, there are these bridges.
Well, there are these possibilities, and in some way, I'm wondering whether the writer, the figure of the writer in Haiti, doesn't have great credence and is respected in some form or fashion, is viewed as an important presence.
Absolutely. I mean, but interesting, much more interesting to me too has always been the figure of the reader, and you know, my dad used to tell stories about sort of young men, and maybe he was talking about himself, I don't know, who would go around trying to seduce young women by carrying a book under their arm. It was just, you know, it was kind of sexy to be a philosophe, you know. And so this whole, you know, this whole appeal of...
Did he ever mention which book?
Would you like?
It's certainly, there was a time in my life where I would carry around, you know, Kierkegaard, The Diary of the Seducer. That was a very good one.
Yeah. No, he didn't mention. I don't think it worked that well for him. But we do have all these, you know, I just remember even in my, you know, in my time in Haiti, like, people who, you know, true sophistication was like, people would say, you know, comme a dit l'auteur, and, you know, yeah, as the author said, and it didn't matter who the author was. You know, and the quote would come out, and they were, and then you knew that they were learned. So I think it was this whole notion of this sort of the appeal of the appeal of the reader. I mean, the writer too, because there were some, we had some sort of giant figures in the literature, like Jacques Romain, and even some, you know, like Felix Maurice Leroy, who walked amongst us, like he was with us in Miami, for example, until he died. And people would sort of revere that presence. But there was also a kind of reverence I find for readers and for reading.
And in Create Dangerously, you spend some pages on the reader, and even the title of the book, the way you interpret Camus' lecture, is also not only the notion of creating dangerously, but reading dangerously, exposing yourself, as Morel did, to some ugly parts of the world, and in some way, by photographing them and by writing about the ugliness, you speak truth to power. And I was, when reading those passages, I was reminded of this line, which I'd like to read to you and have you react to. Since you do mention a lot of European writers and some American writers, you mention Ralph Waldo Emerson and you mention Ralph Waldo Ellison. I like that. But here there's a line that struck me as perhaps working very well with your work, and I wonder if you know it. And it's a line by Kafka where he says, "If the book we are reading does not wake us as with a first hammering on our skulls, then why do we read it?" Good God, we also would be happy if we had no books, and such books that make us happy, we could, if we need be, write ourselves. What we must have are those books. And I would say that to some extent you have offered us that book that Kafka is describing with this book. What we must have are those books that come on us like ill fortune, like the death of one we love better than ourselves, like suicide. A book must be an ice axe to break the sea frozen inside us.
Mm-hmm. That's fantastic. I mean, I think we all know when we've read those types of books because we mourn them. We sort of wonder, you know, when you emerge from that book and you're just like, what will I ever read again? I mean, you have that we're sort of book orphans, you know, after you read those books that mean this to you.
Did you try to do that, Danny Lafarrière? I'm sorry.
No, I didn't try to do that. No, but I, if.
No, but I think you.
I took hammers to my head at times, but.
What I mean to say, actually, Edwidge, quite seriously, is that that chapter 11 I mentioned, and the way you describe real pain and real suffering, seems to me to have an urgency of trying to do what Sontag talks about when she talks about photography, trying also to reawaken, to untarnish the wound and show it clearly, and actually make us shiver.
Yeah. No, I think it's, I always feel, I mean, it goes back to this issue of accidents of literacy. I always feel the weight and my pleasure of having that experience of completely being lost, in something. And I think sometimes it goes both for reading and writing, you know, where you feel so lucky when you're writing, where you're completely lost in it. But one experience, for example, Danny Laferrière, Haitian Canadian writer, he talks often about this experience of the reader, and a reader who repatriates the writers, because he says, when he wrote a novel called Je suis un écrivain japonais, I'm a Japanese writer, saying that if I'm read by a Japanese reader, I become a Japanese writer. But he uses his own case of having these, these passionate reading experiences that I think sometimes are most heartfelt, perhaps in adolescence, because you're not expecting to have such a sort of passionate love affair with book. And he talks about, these writers, of course, they were repatriated, Whitman, Cervantes, has a whole list. And he says, otherwise, what were they doing in my room? They were living there with me under the blanket with the pillow. And he sort of challenges this notion of even immigrant writing, because is there such a thing as an immigrant reader, I think every reader knows, when you're having that experience of just like you don't want, you're sort of savoring every word. And I think one hopes to do that as for a reader, as a writer, which is probably where, for a lot of writers, I think the reader and the writer overlap.
Well, you state in your book that when the pain is too great, you go from writing to reading.
Mm-hmm.
Reading becomes a shield. Reading becomes a refuge.
Yeah, and that's always, I mean, for me, they've always been, together, in the sense that because you felt it's that there's a the Maya Deren quote that's the epigraph to the book, where she's sort of like the revelation of that first creation. I think for a lot of writers, that is tied to reading, to sort of this amazing experience of feeling that hammer and then taking it, perhaps, foolhardily to that next step and saying, oh, I want to do that. And realizing through it that it's not as easy, but I think if you have that sort of great passion, the cherished passion for reading, you're always aiming to create for others that sensation, that urgent sensation that you feel yourself when you're immersed in something you really love.
Explain to me the subtitle of your book,
mm-hmm.
which is The Immigrant Artist at Work.
Okay. Well, the other Camus piece that sort of overshadows this book is a short story called Journal ou l'artiste au travail, Jonas or the Artist at Work. And it's a fascinating short story. People often they'll criticize Camus for being a great writer but not a good storyteller, and that sort of he resolves conflicts too easily and so forth. But I think in the short stories they tend to be so epic. And this one is about this painter who suddenly starts having some success, and then his house gets bigger, but everybody wants to have lunch with him, and slowly the work gets more pushed aside, and it's sort of a slow progression. He starts having more children, and all this story, and it's a lot. And I thought I was so, if you can imagine, sort of it's an essayist's inclination maybe that he shows in actually subtitling this thing L'artiste au travail. It's sort of meant to be a kind of récit in a way, like showing this, and so that's taken from that, L'artiste immigrant au travail. And I kept, I've had since then feeling like, oh, the subtitle is so wrong, because it implies something bigger than it is. It was meant to be maybe one immigrant artist at work, but there were so many a few that I profiled. So the proper title, subtitle might have been, the immigrant artist, maybe Haitian, maybe not Haitian, sometimes at work, sometimes not. But that was that was too long for the front of the book.
When you say maybe Haitian, maybe not Haitian, what do you mean?
Well, because I do, the immigrant artists I talk about, some are Haitian, some are not. Particularly, there's another fascinating artist for me was Michael Richards, who was a sculptor, who was sort of a sculptor of flight. Everything he did was flight related, and he did these sculptures of his own body pierced by airplanes, and people falling out of the sky, and he, it turns out, you know, ends up dying on 9/11 in the World Trade Center. And one of these, they used to do these offices for artists. You know, they had an empty space, they would give it to an artist. And he was there that day. And his whole work, when you look back on it, almost seems prophetic, almost like, you know, you wonder if he was what we would call double-sided, like if was he clairvoyant? Did he sort of have this sense that he was going to die? But and so he's, you know, he's in there and he's not Haitian. And James Baldwin is kind of there in that essay called Another Country, which doesn't mention him, but had, you know, that nod. And so it's sort of you give a fiction writer this format and they just cram everything in because we feel like we never have this chance again. So everybody's in this.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the format, and then I want to talk to you about what you do when the world is on fire. The format interests me because so often it's a case that essayists aspire to the condition of novelists. A very good example, I think, might be Susan Sontag, who tried her hand with degrees of success that remain to be ascertained in the novelistic form. In your case, you have gone from the novelistic form to this essay form. And I'm wondering what you are flirting with here when you try your hand at the essay, what the essay affords you that you might not be able to do when you write novels or short stories.
Well, I had, you know, I've been writing over the years some essays while I was writing fiction, and what it always, you know, it sort of it forced me in a way to be, I think, declarative, if you will, about certain things, even as I was forming my own feeling about things. And
did that make you feel uncomfortable?
But I sort of, there's such a, in fiction too, but I felt that there were many ways. I mean, in this type of essay, you can it's even like the French essay, it's almost like you can be...
An attempt,
exactly.
You know, the word essay both means an attempt, a trial, but it also comes from the word assay, which means to weigh.
Mm-hmm.
So to...
Exactly. Well, exactly. But it gives this opportunity to sort of explore something that you're thinking in this way and to sort of play with this journalistic element. And there are truly things, you know, like that I feel like it would be hard to do in fiction, like
such
this
as.
This piece about Daniel, like if you had a character who had this epiphany, it's too easy in fiction in a way, you know. But and there's the thing too that in this essay, like, you know, the artist in his time, which I've been calling Create Dangerous, but there's where Camus talks about this too, at this sort of the ambivalence of things and just coming, you know, just trying to find a subject in your own mind and just I prefer, that goes to this term of essay, this an essay that's also a kind of search, you know, it's sort of trying, an attempt at trying to come to a conclusion, knowing that it's not definitive, but it's saying sort of, this is what I see, this is how I see it. And not that you should see it the same way, but it's sort of this moment. And there's so much to sort of delve into from places, things to connect in a way, that life helps you too, and sometimes there's some marvelous connections that occur all by themselves that are amazing in nonfiction when they come together. That feels sort of like a revelation that you don't make happen as you do in fiction, but that the sort of the universe is collaborating on with you.
I mentioned that I would get to this point, which is the title of an extraordinary novel by the Portuguese writer Antonio Lobo Antunes, what do you do when the world is on fire? And in part, you describe in your first chapter what the recourse of literature was when the world was on fire. Haitians would perform a play by Camus again called Caligula. And I'm wondering whether you could in some way explain or express what recourse literature offered in moments of extreme terror and pain.
Well, one of the things that when I was also looking into that, I would ask family members. There was in the place where I grew up, in the neighborhood in
Bel Air,
and there was a centre d'études, sort of a center there where people went to study. And my uncle, you know, talked for years about sort of the plays that the young people put on there, and one of them was, I believe, Caligula, based on how they described it, and others, and another one.
You were not sure.
I was not sure, and I didn't want to, you know, I didn't want to say I was sure, and then somebody would come and said, you know, you lie, like your rug on the floor, like. But so there is, just from what they were saying, I, you know, by the time that I could belabor it, they were gone. But another play that they put on, was a Haitian written version of Antigone by Félix Maurice Leroy. And it was particularly poignant at this time. And there was also Marcel Numa had a writer uncle, Nono Numa, who had redone Le Cid in a Haitian setting. And they did this, for example, Antigone, if you do Antigone at a time where people can't pick up dead bodies on the street, it is the, you know, it's a scene so far removed, going, it goes back so far to the Greeks that it gives these, that was part of their creating dangerously, you know, because it gave them a sort of veil of credible deniability, which a lot of, I think, Haitian political art has, you know, a lot of the music, the protest music, at difficult times where people could say, I'm singing about a leaf, or this is a play about somebody in a time that has nothing to do with us. But when you look at, if you look at the Caligula of Camus, or if you look at the Antigone of Félix Maurice Leroy, there are certainly parallels, and the people it's meant for recognize them. But it was this other way of creating without completely risking your life.
The book is dedicated, the first line is 200,000 and more.
Well, I was there borrowing from Toni Morrison, who actually, the book comes as a result of a series of lectures that they do at Princeton in Toni Morrison's name, and I had the honor of doing the second of the lectures, which was the first essay.
And she mentioned you on the stage with Angela Davis 2 weeks ago.
Wow, I can die now. I really, if not for my small children, that's she's actually shown extraordinary kindness.
But just don't.
Okay. But I was, you know, and I think in one of the epigraphs to Beloved is the 16 million. It was sort of a reference to that. But of course, I had been working on the book before. The book started really in 2008 after I did the lecture. But we were about, you know, it was about to we were really far along in it when the earthquake happened. And I thought it was a way of acknowledging that. But the strange thing was sort of the Maya Deren quote, which was part of the book long before, and where she talks about remembering, you know, memory and memoriam, and sort of resisting this idea of constant and memoriam, but also going along with that, a kind of celebration. And that's partly what I wanted this to be, like an elegy, but also a celebration of what remains, of what we, of all those wonderful things that we have left.
But I'm always struck in the English language by the strengths of the word remembering, because it really means literally to put the members back together. And and one of the haunting images, I think, in your book, which comes back as an obsession, is the our place of burial.
Mm-hmm.
I think, is it your aunt who passed away, I think, not very long ago, but who was unwilling to move from her locale because she had built a mausoleum to her daughter and wanted to be buried there. And you describe the 2 or 3 day journey you took in the mountains to get to her. Why this obsession and one could say interest in the very place of burial, as you are indeed very interested in Numa and Ruin's place where they were shot?
Well, I think because it's so, it's one of those things. I mean, I think probably for a lot of families, the, you know, after the earthquake, of all the sad things, one of the sad things was that for a lot of people there, that there is no particular place of burial, sort of where you're buried is so crucial. My aunt Eliana was the one person in our family who never, you know, she didn't go through those layers of migration that people go to, first from the countryside to the city. Then she just kind of stayed where my father's ancestral village was. And to go see her, it's quite a, you know, I think it's like a 2 day trek. And I remember just bathe in nostalgia when I got there. I said to her, I immediately declared, I said, you know, I want to be buried here. This is where I want to be buried. And, you know, she's a very funny woman. She looked at me and she said, did you not climb for 2 days? Who's going to carry a corpse this long? This long? And I said, you know, and okay, I said, I'll shift the plan, you know, I'll be cremated. And she said, no, we have enough dust in Haiti. You don't need to act. But she was still, you know, we had in this, my great grandparents' grave are there. And I was, you know, I was thrilled to see it. But she had built for her daughter, who had died young, a kind of mausoleum in the right behind the house, and that's where she wanted to be buried. And it's not very unusual to go in many places in the Haitian countryside where you see a very elaborate tombstone and a very modest house, and sometimes the burial place is much more beautifully painted, much more, you know, fancier than the house, which gives you a sense of what it means to sort of your place of burial. And I often, you know, stretch it maybe and go, I think sometimes we're like, you know, like the ancient Egyptians in a way. It was sort of this constant, you know, fascination with death, but not even fascination, because this understanding that death goes along with life.
In other words, it is not morbid.
It's not, I mean, on a mass catastrophic scale, of course, but in an individual sort of spiritual way, it's this continuation. And what was fascinating to me is that, you know, when I was staying there in the mountains with my aunt, she would have conversations with her daughter. You know, the night we were there, she would say, you know, Edwige is here. She's Mira's daughter. And it was still
she wasn't quite sure who you were.
Yeah, she wasn't.
Also,
yeah.
She didn't quite know if you were the writer.
Yeah, she called me. She called me a journaliste, which is still, you know, which is probably the highest kind of writer that of her experience. And it was sort of an honorable title.
Not everybody gets, though, a mausoleum or a tomb. In the last chapter, which appeared first in the pages of The New Yorker, you describe Maxo's death and finding his remains and finding his date of birth and death on a makeshift tomb. Mm-hmm. Is it still there that way?
It still is there. My cousin Maxo, who actually I wrote about in Brother I'm Dying, a memoir that I had written previously to this book, died in the earthquake. And the interesting thing was that he has a maternal cousin. He's my cousin on my father's side, who sort of stood vigil at the site and was able, with cooperation from a lot of people in the neighborhood, to save Maxo's wife and three of his kids, but one perished with Maxo. And she kept saying, you know, before we could get there, she kept saying, I want to make sure that when you come back, that there'll be a place to visit, that you'll be able to pay your respects someplace. And it was very important to her. And I had imagined in that mind, because Maxo was sort of a free, willing person, I had imagined him, this not being as important to him as it was for this cousin. And finally, when they did find him, and this happened with a lot of families, they couldn't, he wasn't taken out of that. So he was just basically where they dug a hole and he was buried there. But they went, which I found so extremely loving, which you see in all the also different manifestations, all different places that she had, they had cemented. And then they had put the date of his birth and the date of his death. And when you look at the date of this death, to realize that sort of your individual person shares this date of death with so many people. So that if we had, you know, if you had a visible cemetery that all these lives were suspended on that one particular day. And I think that's what, that was sort of, filled me the most with, like, standing there, and that, you know, you see the very singular date of birth, you know, of his, and then you see this other date that is shared with so many people.
You say in the book that someone, maybe you had made the comment that there were not plaques around everywhere. Mm-hmm. And there can't be plaques around everywhere, because the whole cities would be covered with plaques, mm-hmm, of the dead.
Well, actually, this was when I would talk to a lot of people about Numai Ndwuren, this execution, and as I would about other things, sort of memorial, and I sort of maybe it's from living here too long and going to, you know, a place like Washington, D.C., where you turn around and every place is a memorial. And I would say, you know, about a massacre of Haitian cane workers in the Dominican Republic in 1937, I would go to that river and I would say to myself, well, why isn't there a plaque here? And so I used to say this about the cemetery where Numai Ndwuren had been executed. And actually right before the earthquake, when Daniel was in Haiti, and I said to him, Daniel, just like before the book goes to press, you know, take some pictures for me. I just want to make sure at that place that there's still no plaque before I say there's no plaque. And I was saying this to someone, not Daniel, and the person before this, the earthquake, and the person said, you know, enough with your plaques, because if we were doing plaques, there would be plaques all over the city. And then I sort of had disengaged this notion of sort of constant memorials. But this forces this situation, you know, where I felt it standing there over Max's grave, is that it's like we are the plaques, you know. It's like you have to kind of be the people who are, you know, family members, the friends, and you have to be like the living memorial for these people. A lot of them, you know, who have no other, there's no possible way that they're remembered except through this memory. And I had sensed this many, many years with Numai Ndwuren before, when I was thinking about this other kind of remembrance and how do they live, but this memory of how they transformed a young boy's life, you know, and so now this is true for in such a much larger sense, and that we are all walking around. We're like sort of the mausoleums behind the house of these people. Many of them of you know, have no trace.
So writing is a form of haunting in some way.
Yeah, among other things. I mean, I sometimes feel privileged that I have this way of doing it. And
do you sometimes feel that you have the burden of being a spokesperson for Haiti?
Not a burden. I sometimes joke that I do PR for Haiti, and it's a privilege. And because I love to share this other parts of Haiti that I know. These writers, these creators, this art. I love to share that. That's the sunny part. The other part is there's no burden in it, beyond the burden I think of any other artist with a story that is just that you feel like is weaved into your soul.
You know, Edwidge, you know this, and I feel you encouraged me to say this tonight, so I will. Haiti has been part of my life for as long as I remember. My parents. It's an unknown, very unknown story. Maybe someday I'll be able to write it. My parents fled Vienna in 1938 and 39 and spent the war years in Haiti. There were 107 Jewish families in Haiti. My father, who was a medical student, became a farmer in Haiti, growing vegetables that hadn't been grown before and which now still exist there, certain kinds of cauliflower, so that when we went to the markets of Kenskoff and Turgeau and other places, he would show me these vegetables and say, this, you know, this is my legacy.
Broccoli.
Yeah, certain forms. And so my father, whose name is Kurt, still some people still remember him, Monsieur Kurt. You know, he's now 92 years old. And just this morning when I was mentioning to him and to my mother that we were talking, they of course were sending you very warm regards. And my mother said, you know, it's such a different life because we fled Vienna to find refuge in Haiti. And my mother started her love of literature by reading books that a man whose name I should mention, my mother, and I'm wondering if this person, André Larac, a man named André Larac, whose I think brother became an ambassador, would give my mother, she was 13 years old, books to read. So her discovery of literature happened on your island. At the age when she arrived in Haiti is the age at which you left Haiti for America.
Yeah, and how extraordinary that, you know, do we ever think of Haiti as a place of refuge? I mean, how extraordinary is that, you know, that I feel like it's something wonderful to share. Yeah. And Paul Larac was an extraordinary poet I think the brother of your mother's Larac. No, it's phenomenal.
The sunny side of Haiti, though, is something that you also try to bring forward by quoting and encouraging some of your readers to discover some of these writers who are fairly unknown in this country, but that you discovered yourself by going to the Brooklyn Public Library. So when you were 12 or 13 years old, you discovered a shelf at the Brooklyn Public Library. Tell us something about that discovery, particularly since we are here in another of those libraries.
In the library. You know, libraries have always felt like almost like church to me. And I would go to that particular branch, you know, they just started having this section, Les Vahitiens, and I had not, I mean, it's ironic, I wasn't taught Haitian literature in Haiti. You know, we were taught French literature, read excerpts, and so when I came here, I was looking for things about Haiti to read, and they had this little shelf of Les Vahitiens, and most of the books were, you know, political type books, and a lot of poetry. We have a lot of poets, but then there were these two short books, the Gigi Dominique's Memoir d'une Amnésiaque, Gigi being the daughter of Jean-Dominique, the radio journalist, and the Jacques Roumain novel, which is much longer than in French than it is than the Langston Hughes translation. And so I kept going back to that shelf until thankfully it kept growing. But it was a kind of revelation that in all my efforts to share writers that I love, Haitian writers I love, with other people, that I wish on others, that sense of discovery of just like, oh, this person is like me, and I recognize this, because I think, you know, when you read voraciously, sometimes you read to escape, but sometimes you read, you know, especially when you're 13, 14, you're looking for a kind of mirror of yourself. And so that's what I found there in the library. And I could never, it took me a very long time to get over the fact that you were allowed to go home with those books from the library. I was like, are you kidding me? I can have 10 and I can take it and they trust me.
You have to return them.
Oh.
at some point.
Oh, that's the catch, huh?
Yeah.
I did return them, but it still felt so, I mean, I remember just like reading through them so quickly, because I just couldn't believe that I could walk away. I mean, that's one of the amazing things, that there are very few lending libraries, if you will, in Haiti, but the ones that they do have,